Hello and welcome to the Theotivity podcast. My name is Thaddeus and I'm glad that you've joined me for this episode of the podcast. Today we're going to be talking about a really important topic that I've been wanting to address for a while and I've been doing quite a bit of significant research on it. This will be the first iteration though of this and it's more meant as an introduction and perhaps a little bit of a quick diagnostic tool on this topic. I'm talking about the issue of cultural Marxism. What is that term and what does it mean? Well, tune in to this episode and find out.
The Theotivity Podcast. Theotivity is the place where theology and creativity come together. Here you'll find audio narration of articles, episodes exploring the faith, culture, the arts, and media, systematic theology, apologetics, guest interviews with Christian thinkers, creatives, pastors, theologians, and much more. At theotivity.com, you'll find articles and resources to help you grow in your faith, as well as a portfolio of creative works. Like, share, and subscribe to stay up to date on the latest content.
There is a cultural phenomenon at play today in our societies that has taken captive the minds and hearts of many. It is a dangerous and deceptive ideology that pretends to be a vision of justice and compassion, but only brings destruction and violence. It has infiltrated almost every institution and every area of society. From colleges and universities to government, to media to entertainment and major corporations and multinational organizations, and even into many churches and faith organizations. It acts like a Trojan horse that introduces what seems to be a benign or even helpful tool, but is actually a fatal poison that spreads disease throughout its host. It preys on people's compassion and emotions and can turn friends, families, and whole communities against each other. It destabilizes societies and brings devastation to nations plagued by its tenets. What is this phenomena? Well, it's often called by many different names and related terms. Cultural Marxism is perhaps one of the names that it goes by and has generated a lot of controversy. Some of the popular terms and related but slightly different concepts associated with it are things like social justice, critical theory, and the ever-popular term wokeness. I'm sure you may have heard that. I'll address these terms in future posts and articles and episodes probably, because this is a major cultural issue that I think we need to speak to. Either way, this is the predominant ideology of the political left, or what is more popularly called leftism today. These aren't just your classical liberals of yesteryear, though. These are rather today's ideological radical left. The two-spirit ones with the blue and purple hair, the Molotov cocktails, and the mostly peaceful protests that burned down half of your city, those guys. This is the religion of much of our cultural elites even, and institutions of learning and media. It is the framework behind the bastions of unbiased reporting like CNN, ABC, MSNBC, CBC, CTV, CP24, and other acronyms of leftist political propaganda machines posing as fake news channels. Now, before I lose some of you in the vagaries of my intro, if you live in contact with the modern Western societies, you've probably all encountered this phenomena of cultural Marxism before. For example, we all watched as BLM riots broke out over the tragic death of George Floyd in 2020. This spark ignited the tinder, which was already primed in our culture due to the saturation of principles of cultural Marxism that have been seeping in, perhaps under the radar. Many have had to go through mandatory diversity, equity, and inclusion trainings, or seen and or experienced affirmative action programs at work, schools, and other institutions. This is a direct outworking of critical theory and, more broadly, cultural Marxism. The LGBTQ agenda has also made use of this ideology to further its causes, as well as the hashtag MeToo movement and other victim cults. Now, not downplaying actual victims here, just saying that there are some victim cults that kind of act in cultic ways. We've seen this phenomena at play in calls to tear down statues and other symbols. It is said of oppressive colonialism and the past. Its principles are even seen in some initiatives by global elites who push radical environmentalism and zero carbon goals, and visions of a socialistic utopia, if only they would be given enough power. Now, the term cultural Marxism isn't without its own baggage. I'll admit that. There are some on the political left who try to gaslight discussion around the term by labeling it a right-wing anti-Semitic conspiracy theory because of his critique of ideas which stem from the Frankfurt School, which was comprised of Jewish philosophers coming out of Germany. It's often also tied to what is painted as unwarranted critiques of political correctness. However, valid critique of bad ideas hardly could count as anti-Semitic just because the originators happen to be Jewish. A bad idea is bad, no matter the ethnicity or of the people or person that it originates from. Furthermore, the connection and lineage of cultural Marxism to classical Marxism's ideology is actually undeniable, and despite attempts to discredit and the validity of this term and dismiss its importance, we see the influence of this phenomena all over our culture. So now, it's true that the term cultural Marxism often lacks clear definition and can be quite nebulous, a sort of catch-all label for anything that conservatives might deem as dangerous ideology. And as, you know, the Christian apologist Neil Shenvey, who I really found helpful on his blog and website, he says, quote, "What exactly is a cultural Marxist? What do they believe? If we can't point to a body of academic literature or a set of books or a set of shared ideals with which the majority of cultural Marxists would agree, then it's not a particularly useful term." And he has a point there. So I do think that there's a valid critique of the actual helpfulness of this term. Perhaps some of the confusion around these issues is a lack of clearly defined terms to work with, though. However, not wanting to let this article and episode die the death of a thousand qualifications, which already it is dangerously close to doing, so do not, the group of concepts that this term is meant to encapsulate, I think, are still pertinent points of concern. So we're just going to go with it. Okay. In any case, whatever the name you give this phenomenon, there are some defining characteristics about it which are important to understand today. And here I'm going to outline 10 defining features of this phenomena of cultural Marxism, or whatever it is you want to call it, which I perceive today as a common threat in our culture that Christians should be aware of. This is not an exhaustive list, by the way, but rather is meant as an introduction, as I intend on more fully and academically perhaps exploring these ideologies in depth in future articles and episodes on the website. However, also this list is meant to be more of a diagnostic and not a cure. So I'm not going to be focusing as much on what we do in place of. This is more helping people to recognize the threat. Future episodes and articles may consider biblical responses a bit more in depth. Although I think some of those responses may be pretty self-evident once we do this diagnosis, because it's very readily apparent that this is anti-biblical. So let's get started. In no particular order, here are 10 defining features of cultural Marxism. So firstly, it is anti-Christian. You see, it's based on classical Marxism, which is an openly naturalistic, materialistic, anti-theistic system of thought. It's not neutral and intentionally subverts the Christian worldview. Thus, it can't be used as a helpful analytical tool, but it has to be rejected as a competing religion. Now, some Christians and even Christian leaders, such as in the SBC, have tried to co-opt some of the principles of this ideology to use them as helpful analytical tools. However, this is a fool's errand. They don't realize that these are not just tools held in abstraction that you can go pick up and use like a cordless Dyson vacuum, without also drawing from its source and taking in its worldview. You see, the tools of intersectionality, critical theory, affirmative action, and reparations are not incidental, but rather a part of the interconnected network of beliefs one has to implicitly accept in order to use it. You can't milk this cow without buying it. This is because these tools only have worth if you agree with the starting principles and presuppositions of cultural Marxist thought, which has a very different view of origins, of sin, or what went wrong with the world, redemption, and the future hope than what Christians would believe in our worldview. Now, Karl Marx, whose thoughts and writings form the origin of much of the basis of these modern iterations of this ideology, he was also a radical atheist who was set against God and Christianity in particular. Now, if you've not read or listened to the article and episode 10 Dark Facts About Karl Marx, you should go back and check it out on either the blog or the podcast. Now, we must be clear. These ideas and ideologies that stem from classical Marxism are radically opposed to a biblical worldview. The devil often wears his shiniest angel clothes when he's trying to get you to drink his poison. His answers to the fundamental questions of where do we come from and what were we created for, what went wrong with the world, and how can things be made right, are diametrically opposed to the Christian worldview and thus anti-Christian. Secondly, another distinguishing factor is oppression. Oppression. The theme of oppression is one of the common traits of the ideologies which could be nested under this umbrella term of cultural Marxism. It believes that society is made up of systems of power and privilege that need to be deconstructed. If cultural Marxism had a doctrine of original sin, this would be pretty close to it. It sees all reality in light of oppression and divides society up into classes or identity groups. The chief examples of these identity groups are, for example, men versus women, heterosexuals versus homosexuals and transgendered, whites versus blacks, Hispanics and Asians, first world citizens versus third world immigrants, rich versus poor, and business owners versus employees. These identity groups are today's adaptations of classical Marxism's proletariat and bourgeoisie classes. This focus on oppression also leads to a related concept of intersectionality, which is an important concept to understand. It considers the multiple intersections of oppressed identities that a person may suffer under in order to figure out how to privilege them to compensate for their perceived disadvantage. Thus, it tends to be radically cynical and suspicious, assuming that oppression is hidden in every single system and institution and needs to be found, condemned, and dismantled, leading to many witch hunts, of course, to find the oppressive boogeyman lurking under the seemingly peaceful exterior. These ideologies co-opt a biblical term, oppression, and twist its meaning to mean something that's anti-biblical. You see, no longer is oppression about actual instances of unjust treatment or the use of undue force, power, or position to subjugate someone or a group unjustly. Instead, it's assumed to be inherent in any relationship where there's some disparity, whether in power, roles, economics, or other factors. Oppression in this system does not need to be proven, it's assumed. And this will be a big part of the frustration in trying to reason with someone who is a true believer of cultural Marxism. So, for example, you could happen to be a person of Caucasian descent whose ancestors were enslaved by North African slave traders, and that's something which actually happened quite a lot in the past. But the mere fact that your melanin count is lower than your more tanned and darker fellow image bearers would make you complicit in the system of oppression that now exists in Western nations that is said to favor people of lighter skin colors. You are an oppressor because of belonging to the majority identity group associated with power, not because of actual instances of oppression that you've committed. Now, this erroneous line of thinking has been adopted by some evangelical leaders and pastors who would have been considered conservative. For example, Tim Keller, a popular pastor and author and co-founder of the Gospel Coalition, has argued on this point. I'll play a clip for you right now.
Studies have shown, have pretty much proven, that if you have white skin, it's worth $1 million over a lifetime over somebody who doesn't have white skin. And that's because of historical forces that have come about. And at this point, you know, you could go at it several ways. One, as I mentioned, if you have that asset of white skin right now, historical asset, then you actually have to say, I didn't deserve this. And also, I'm the product of, I'm standing on the shoulders of other people who got that through injustice. So the Bible actually says, yes, you are involved in injustice. And even if you didn't actually do it, therefore you have a responsibility, not just to say, well, you know, maybe if I get around to it, maybe we could do something about the poor people out there. No, you're part of the problem. If you do actually let your understanding of responsibility be shaped by the Bible instead of American individualism.
So basically, Keller is saying that if you have white skin, you are automatically complicit in the system of oppression and have unfair advantage because of that quote-unquote asset of white skin to the sum of $1 million or so, right? That's his basic sort of argument. But if that's true, then my wife's family, who happens to be Caucasian and white, would definitely like to find out where that $1 million went. Again here, even if Keller's assumption was correct, and it's not, he takes for granted that that advantage must have been because of some injustice or oppression. It can't possibly be that someone's advantage in life over another person might have been gained through hard and honest work. This automatic assumption that the advantage that this person has is must mean that some injustice happened is really just nonsensical. Also, it doesn't make any sense in terms of what the Bible actually teaches about leaving an inheritance. Suppose the advantage that that family or that person has is because their father or grandfather and descendants before them actually followed biblical precepts to leave an inheritance for their offspring. And that's why they have a little bit of a leg up. Now, is that unjust? No, that's actually biblical. And, you know, Keller is very way off here on what the Bible teaches about this. I mean, Deuteronomy 24:16, for example, says that fathers shall not be put to death because of their children, nor shall children be put to death because of their fathers. Each one shall be put to death for his own sin. You see, we don't pay for the sins of others that the sins that we didn't even commit. That's unjust. And not only that, like, just because you have white skin doesn't mean that you're somehow genetically related to the people in the past who happened to also have white skin and committed crimes. So it becomes really hard to trace some sort of lineage to make you guilty. It also doesn't accord with what God says in Ezekiel 18, for example. Ezekiel 18, 19 to 20 says, you know, yet you say, why should not the son suffer for the iniquity of the father? But then it says, when the son has done what is just and right and has been careful to observe all my statutes, he shall surely live. The soul who sins shall die. The son shall not suffer for the iniquity of the father, nor the father suffer for the iniquity of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon himself. You see, God's justice is direct. This type of messed up social justice is indirect. It actually punishes people who have no direct association with the crimes, the alleged injustices that were committed. That's just not right. And Keller is unfortunately very off here on this point. Now, I will say this with regards to Keller. He's done a lot of things that have been helpful and written and produced a lot of material that's been helpful to the church. I know his book, Meaning of Marriage, was really helpful to my wife and I as we were engaged and moving towards marriage, and benefited from some of his other work as well. So not totally writing him off or saying that, you know, the man never said anything good. But it seems like on these issues of social justice, and I've even seen tweets about abortion from him that have been really, really concerning and seem to, you know, buy in to this sort of leftist cultural Marxist ideas. And perhaps he's not self-consciously bought into it, although I have my suspicions because he's quite an educated and well-read man. I really wonder, but I can't read his heart, so I have to try to give the most generous interpretation and give the benefit of the doubt. But on these issues, it seems like a lot of things that he's been saying and tweeting are not in line with the Bible, and seems to give indication that he has bought into at least some of this cultural Marxism. And he's not alone in this. There's been other Gospel Coalition writers and authors and speakers, even guys who, you know, I've benefited a lot and who I think has been a, you know, very solid proclaimers of the gospel, like Matt Chandler and David Platt, have said some really concerning things. And perhaps in future episodes, as we dive deeper into this topic, we'll cover some of those. Hey friends, I just wanted to take a quick moment to ask for your support. If you've benefited from the ministry of Theotivity, please prayerfully consider partnering with me by giving a donation of any amount. Big or small, it all helps. I want to keep Theotivity going and to find ways to make it financially self-sufficient. I'd also like to be able to invest in advertising and upgrades to improve the quality of the content, all of which require money. To date, I've paid for everything out of pocket. However, with a young family, we recently adopted a little baby boy, and other commitments, this is not something I can reasonably continue to do without your help. When I started Theotivity, I had no clue if or how God would use it. It was an experiment in stepping out in faith to build something for the sake of the kingdom. I'm happy to announce that God has used it in surprising ways, with the site receiving at least 2,000 to 3,000 visits consistently per month, and a podcast steadily growing in listenership. I'm genuinely humbled and give glory to God. If you're like me, I know you long to see more solid Christian content getting out there, but that takes time, effort, and money. So, if this is something that you'd like to see continue, and if you found value in the content here at Theotivity, skip a few fancy latte drinks from your favorite woke coffee shop, and please consider donating at theotivity.com/donate. You can find links to donate in the description of this post or episode. Thanks so much. Now, back to the episode. Thirdly, another distinguishing factor of cultural Marxism and the ideology that it espouses is its focus on disparity. So, related to the previous point, it sees all disparity as unjust and proposes a radical agenda of equality of outcomes. This is very different from the concept of equality of value and equality of opportunities, which produces actual justice and fairness. Here, there are two terms that are often confused, and it's not helpful that they're also not used consistently by proponents. The two terms are equity and equality. So equity is often used to speak about equality of outcomes or results, whereas equality is often used to speak of equality of opportunities and status as image bearers. The former is a Marxist concept and the latter is a biblical one. Now, pursuing the equality of outcomes that cultural Marxism champions, or equity, right, necessitates discrimination, theft, and actual oppression. And this is where the concept of reparations and affirmative action that intentionally discriminate and even penalize people who are considered a part of that oppressor group in order to equalize the outcomes for minority groups come from. It is explicitly anti-capitalist and anti-free market, and thus it tends to promote more socialistic and communistic attitudes towards the economy and society, since capital-free markets lead to disparities which it perceives as inherently unfair. However, just because Johnny has more money or has earned a place at an Ivy League school or university, let's say, doesn't automatically mean that Johnny got there by unjust means, which necessitates some sort of punishment. Not all disparity is a result of injustice. Some people may simply have certain advantages due to their intellect, their physical makeup or sex, the place they were born, and a whole host of other factors. Also, each person is a unique individual who makes free choices that are different from others' free choices. And this freedom necessarily means that there will be inevitably be disparity in the outcomes. The only way that you could eliminate all disparities then is to actually eliminate freedom itself. And hence why these cultural Marxists and their causes also tend to not like Western liberal democracies and is actually a threat to our freedoms. This concern for equal outcomes, though, is shown to be the farce that it is, in that no one is calling for affirmative action for more white or brown or Asian guys in the NBA or other sports where black men have dominated historically. It's only when a minority or oppressed group by the standards of the cultural Marxists are involved that concern for equality of outcome is even raised. Disparities are not necessarily unjust, though. They sometimes just are. For example, if I'm a 5'9" half Asian who can't dunk to save his life, then the LA Lakers picking Shaquille O'Neal over me is not unjust. It's just common sense. And nor is it unfair that I could whoop Shaq's butt in a game of table tennis. The only affirmative action needed here is affirming that watching Shaq dunk over guys is far more entertaining than watching me hit them with ping pong balls, at least in the long run. Fourthly, another distinguishing marker of cultural Marxism is its view of truth. Its thinking is closely tied to postmodernism, which holds that objective knowledge is impossible. But cultural Marxism, especially in its activist sort of forms, goes even further. Every absolute must be demolished because knowledge is seen as a construct of power, which is inherently evil in their minds. Except, of course, for the absolute that there must be no absolutes. Think that one through. Instead, truth is relativized and subjective. Thus, the popular slogan, "Speak your truth," as opposed to "the truth." It also relies on the postmodern knowledge principle, that knowledge is actually not objective or scientifically discovered, but rather it's the result of a construct of power perpetuated by public discourses. This makes it very suspicious of scientific claims of objectivity, because all claims to truth are also made from positions of power, and power bad, you know? That's why also cultural Marxists need more of it to correct the ills of the world, right? Nothing to see here. Just move on. Just give us the power. This negation of objective truth also makes it incredibly hard to reason with, since also logic and reason can be tools of oppressors, of course. A typical tool of truth-finding for cultural Marxists is standpoint epistemology, which is just a fancy word for a new secularized form of popery, claiming infallibility. However, in this system, to become the infallible popes, you have to check your intersectional credentials. If you're a lesbian, trans, black, quarter, native, poor, Buddhist, two-spirit, queer studies major, then you might as well inscripturate everything that you see. But if you happen to be a straight, white, upper, middle class, Christian male, then you might as well just rename yourself Hitler and shut up. You see, standpoint epistemology asserts that the more oppressed your identity groups, or the intersections of your identities, then the more access you have to knowledge that privileged people cannot see and don't want to see. It's a sort of Gnostic knowledge principle. Gnosticism was a heresy in the early centuries that believed that there was this secret knowledge that you have to have in order to be saved. So in cultural Marxism, an oppressed person's viewpoint trumps all statistics and logical argument because you can't argue with their experience. But really, should we be looking to the people who are confused about what is a boy and a girl for advice on how societies should be best run? Now, this is not to negate the importance of listening to people and being empathetic to hear their stories of real hurt and injustice. But without objective truth as our foundation, any attempts at justice will be just arbitrary and otherwise known as foolishness. So therefore, you know, their slogans such as elevating fill-in-the-blank voices and speaking truth to power have real problems at their basic level of defining truth. What truth is it that they're speaking to power? A fifth marker of cultural Marxism is identity groups. We should explain a bit more the importance of identity groups and its relationship to intersectionality. Cultural Marxism focuses on people belonging to certain identity groups, such as according to sex, gender identity, race, sexuality, immigration status, indigeneity, right? So like whether or not you're a native person or not, colonial status, disability, religion, and even weight. One startling omission, though, in this list of intersectional identities is any meaningful mention of economic class. They sometimes raise the point, but almost never substantively so. And this is a distinction from classical Marxism, which was almost entirely obsessed with economic class. In contrast, cultural Marxism seems to ignore it or give it a fairly low importance, because, you know, this would be too inconvenient for the global elites who try to peddle this nonsense upon us. In cultural Marxism, what identity groups you are part of, or which is defined mainly by external demographic and biological details, is absolutely foundational and forefront to your self-identity as a person. Now, this is easily illustrated, for example, in Kimberly Crenshaw's 1991 Mapping of the Margins, which is a foundational intersectionality text. For instance, Crenshaw and her disciples, significant attention is paid to the importance of distinguishing the two phrases, I am black, from I am a person who happens to be black. You see, people are encouraged to primarily identify by their group identity, whether it be gay, lesbian, queer, disabled, ethnic background, and even mental illnesses or depression and anxiety. All of these can become identities. Of course, doing this is strategically beneficial, since now any critique of their position becomes readily interpreted as an attack on their person and categorized as violence and assault. Quite handy, right? This is why questioning the transgender movement's logic, for example, even with questions as basic as, what is a woman? Hey, that'd be a great idea for a documentary. Anyways, even bringing questions so basic are met with charges of denying the humanity of transgender people and hating them. When applied to other fields within cultural Marxism, like fat studies, and yes, that's an actual discipline. For example, it makes the primary identity one's obesity, and the only acceptable response is unqualified praise of the 400-pound bikini model in the ad for vegan zero-carbon avocado toast. This, of course, is nothing to knock at the inherent dignity and worth of a person who may be overweight, and even morbidly so. But if we can't even affirm what are healthy norms, how can we truly say that we're loving? How can a doctor even diagnose health issues that might be related to weight? Now, let's talk to a related concept. Another marker of cultural Marxism is self-actualization. So related to this need for constant affirmation is this concept of self-actualization. It doesn't understand the, you see, cultural Marxism, one of its problems is it doesn't understand the inherent sinfulness of man. The individual is believed to be innocent until corrupted by outside forces, whether it be society or civilization or religion, etc., right? It is the myth of Rousseau's noble savage. Thus, self-actualization is the great human need, not redemption from sin. Thus, radical autonomy is championed, and social barriers to self-actualization, such as the family, the church, businesses, etc., must be redefined, marginalized, or even destroyed. You see, the ultimate goal is the self-actualization of the individual's imagined perception of themselves or what they wish that it would be. Any assertion of norms based on anything outside of the individual are to be torn down, and thus traditional religion that would hold firmly to any body of unmoving doctrine especially becomes a target. Any creational normativity, even the nuclear family structure, is seen as a hindrance to true self-actualization. And this is found in the chorus of almost every Disney princess's theme song, to let their true self out and to be liberated from their parents' suffocation. Thus, you know, we're supposed to affirm things like furries, kids who identify as pets and act as such in schools. And yes, that's actually a thing, as just ask any public teacher, public school teacher. However, no one is willing to be consistent in this type of farce. If we put down dogs, for example, who bite and maim people, and there's been instances of these kids pretending to be furries going rabid and biting other kids, well, I'll let you fill in the gaps there. And I'm not advocating putting down any kids, by the way. Just recognizing that aiding a delusion is not for the good. If I'm laying on the train tracks, for example, in the morning with the GO train about to make me a pancake and not the type that goes well with maple syrup, the last thing I need you to do is to affirm how great my posture is on the tracks or assist me in my fantasies of railroad self-actualization. A seventh marker of cultural Marxism is elitism. You see, it believes that the vast majority of the oppressed can't actually realize their oppression or defend themselves. So it, of course, requires a social elite, a priestly caste who are rightly educated in at the right universities and right prominence and political and power in politics and media and entertainment, who will champion their cause and guide the masses towards their vision of the best solution. So clearly, you have to be highly educated in the right degrees from the right institutions to be this foolish. James Lindsay and Helen Plockrose, in their book, Cynical Theories, which, by the way, is a very helpful book, not written by Christians, but a helpful diagnostic sort of book, they note this on page 185. Quote, "Is therefore no surprise that many working class and poor people often feel profoundly alienated from today's left. It is profoundly ironic that a movement claiming to problematize all sources of privilege is led by highly educated, upper-middle-class scholars and activists who are so oblivious to their status as privileged members of society." Quite the irony. You know, the average blue-collar guy working hard to feed his family of six doesn't have much use for the queer literature major's stunning insights on economics, nor does he have use for the policies of elite politicians born with silver spoons that they use to scoop his hard-earned money out of their pocket, out of his pocket, through excessive taxation and inflationary measures. You see, the irony, of course, is that in combating oppression, these global elites who champion today's cultural Marxist causes oppress the actual vulnerable and call evil good. Woe to these blind guides. Eighthly, eighth marker of cultural Marxism and a focus of it is on language. You see, because it sees all truth and reality as constructs of power perpetuated in discourses, and that's just fancy speak for truth is a language game. You see, there's a heavy emphasis on language and controlling narratives by cultural Marxists. It weaponizes language to redefine or hijack terms, and the use of linguistic shaming or name-calling and buzzwords such as toxic masculinity, systemic racism, heteronormativity, white supremacy, neocolonialism, Black Lives Matter, and cisgenderism, right? Those are all terms that you use. Linguistic and logical traps are common, such as Kafka traps and gaslighting strategies. For example, a Kafka trap. You want a good example of a Kafka trap? Just read the book White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. Actually, or better yet, don't. I'll just explain it to you in three sentences. It is basically this. White people are racist and cannot shut up and accept it because of their fragility over being labeled racist. So if you challenge that truth, it's because of your white fragility. Therefore, your options are to bow down and accept it as true, or reject it and prove that it's true. Hopefully you can see that that is a logical fallacy. Lindsay and Plockrose, they note this. They say, quote, "Nearly all social justice scholarship is concerned with what is said, what is believed, what is assumed, what is taught, what is conveyed, and what biases are imported through teaching, discourses, and stereotypes. All the scholarship starts from the theoretical premise that society works through systems of power and privilege maintained in language, and these create knowledge from the perspectives of the privileged and deny the experiences of the marginalized. Social justice scholarship, therefore, targets science and any other analytical methods that contradict these assumptions or claims made under them." Ninth marker of cultural Marxism is politics. Politics. You see, because it believes that we can achieve utopia through political power, and therefore it politicizes everything. Have you ever noticed that? That like all of these issues have become political. You see, because it frames all of life in terms of oppressed and oppressor, it fixates on power dynamics and differentials. Consequently, it sees the need to seize power to forcibly remake society into its vision of utopia. This aspect is a direct offshoot from classical Marxist theory, which envisioned a proletariat revolution. Thus, it tends towards totalitarianism. Jean Edward Veith, in his book Post-Christian, knows this. He says, quote, "For both post-Marxists on the left and Nietzscheans on the right, all institutions, all governments, all art, all moral beliefs, and all religions are nothing more than a mask for power. All of culture, the family, social institutions, philosophical systems, is nothing more than one group exercising power over another group. Men over women, whites over racial minorities, heterosexuals over homosexuals, humans over animals, etc. Thus, every dimension of life is politicized and critiqued as part of a system of oppression. The only way to resist this oppression is to be transgressive and to seize power for your own group, which will include exercising oppression against your enemies, silencing them, marginalizing them, and otherwise punishing them." So, therefore, all of these causes have become intensely political. This also has proven to be an effective strategy at silencing or paralyzing many Christians who have bought into the sage wisdom that you can't bring religion into politics, given by leaders of this woke cult who bring their religion into everything. As one of its central strategies is a focus on centralized power and top-down solutions, because the, you know, ignorant plebs who are actually working to create economic value can't possibly understand how to make the world a truly better place, right? Anyways, they obviously haven't read enough Karl Marx. That's why they don't see it. I'm obviously being very ironic here and sarcastic. Tenthly, let's wrap this up. The 10th marker of cultural Marxism is conflict and guilt. Conflict and guilt. You see, due to its social evolutionary beliefs, it sees conflict as necessary to progress, and that progress itself can't be made peacefully. Its work is primarily deconstructive and aimed at dismantling the current hegemonic systems of power, with the belief that once these are gone, society will somehow magically right itself once freed of its oppression. You see, for the cultural Marxists, the creation eagerly awaits to be set free from its bondage to capitalism by the sons of Marx and obtain the freedom of utopia of the World Economic Forum. Thus, they are noble warriors fighting for liberation from oppressive categories of male and female pronouns and cow farts. It's really impressive how virtuous cultural Marxists can make their conflict theory sound. But don't be mistaken, it is still conflict theory, and its goal is destruction. You see, there's no hope for redemption for this oppressor class. They can only perpetually repent and do penance via reparations and endless, penances. And they can also maybe become an activist for the cause by divesting themselves of their own power and privilege and elevating approved voices. Therefore, this system also produces a perpetual guilt, but without any remedy. You see, there's no once-for-all atonement that can bring any absolution in cultural Marxism. Only a tiresome works righteousness, which will never actually justify the penitent. Now, I'm going to have to wrap it up here. There's much more that could be said about cultural Marxism, and perhaps this list is not quite complete, but these are some of the trends that I've noticed in common from my observation and research. So I hope that these 10 markers will make it easier for you to identify some of these dangerous ideologies yourself. So just to kind of review on them in terms of the 10 markers that we've covered is one, firstly, it's anti-Christian. Secondly, oppression is a major theme. Thirdly, disparities are heavily emphasized. Fourthly, truth is relative and distorted. Fifthly, identity groups are a big part of this. Sixthly, self-actualization is a big goal. Seventh, it's led by elites and elitism. Eighthly, it warps and weaponizes language. Ninth, it is very heavily focused on politics and top-down forced solutions. And tenthly, it perpetuates guilt and conflict. So in future episodes and articles, we'll consider this cult of wokeness and also start to look at how Christians can bring a biblical worldview to bear on these issues for truly good solutions and answers in our culture today. So stay tuned for future episodes. Until next time, Soli Deo Gloria.
Thanks for listening to the Theotivity podcast. If you found this content helpful or edifying, please leave a review on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, follow us on social media and consider sharing this episode to help Theotivity reach others as well. Check out theotivity.com for resources, info on how to support, and subscribe to our monthly newsletter to stay up to date on all the latest content. Until next time, live and create to the glory of God.